2019 saw many important cases and issues that will shape False Claims Act enforcement today and in the years to come. In this podcast series, we'll analyze some key developments to help you be better prepared if the government comes calling with tough questions. In today's episode, we'll visit with Hogan Lovells partner Mike Vernick and senior associate Mike Scheimer, both from our Washington, D.C. office. They will be discussing cybersecurity and the False Claims Act.
Hi, I'm Mike Scheimer in the government contracts practice.
And I'm Mike Vernick, also in the government contracts practice at Hogan Lovells in Washington, D.C. We appreciate everyone sitting in today to hear our podcast on False Claims Act issues related to U.S. government contract cybersecurity. I'll kick it off and give a very quick overview of two of the cases that we think are particularly relevant in 2019. And then we'll do a little bit of tea leaf reading in terms of what we see happening in 2020. So the first case that we're going to talk about is United States v. Aerojet Rocketdyne Holdings case, Inc. The relator in this case, or the whistleblower, had alleged that the defendant, Aerojet Rocketdyne, hadn't appropriately addressed some vulnerability findings in an externally conducted security assessment and had also falsely certified compliance with some U.S. government cybersecurity requirements. And the second is United States XREL Glenn v. Cisco Systems. And in this case, the relator had raised some allegations that he had identified security vulnerabilities in a Cisco product that would allow an external attacker to exploit the system and even become an administrator of the system, which would allow potential future abuse to go undetected. The whistleblower also raised some concerns that the security flaws were such that other systems that were connected to the Cisco product could themselves be compromised. Here, the contracts through which the government was purchasing this Cisco product required the company to represent that its products were compliant with various National Institute of Standards and Technology requirements. And the complaint in this matter alleged that there were false statements and false claims made that actually rendered the product worthless. The defendant in that case agreed to pay $8.6 million to resolve the matter. So, Mike, I thought I'd ask you a question from a cyber perspective. What you see as particularly relevant in those two matters?
So the cases actually represent two different scenarios for cybersecurity compliance. The Cisco case is the sort of standard IT contractor scenario where the company is providing IT products and services to the government, and it has to represent that it's meeting federal specific cybersecurity standards that are promulgated by NIST under the Federal Information Security Management Act, as amended by the Modernization Act of 2014. And these are security standards that all government IT products and services have to meet, whether procured through a contract or operated in-house by an agency. So in those contexts, the contractor is essentially providing products or services that are agency IT products or services. But as the government buys them, they need to know, do you meet certain cybersecurity standards that are government specific as opposed to, you know, commercial standards? On the other hand, the Aerojet case doesn't even involve IT products or services being sold to the government. It's defense weapon systems. And the cybersecurity compliance issue that arose was the company had to make representations that it meets certain cybersecurity requirements on its own information systems. So this is sort of the new environment we've been seeing kind of in the last few years, where contractors that are not IT contractors, who wouldn't normally expect historically to have to meet government-specific cybersecurity requirements, are finding that federal protections find their way into the contract and they follow the flow of federal information into contractor systems. So I have a question to throw back to you, Mike, that are you surprised that we're seeing cyber-related issues now generating False Claims Act cases?
I think this is something that those of us who practice in the False Claims Act area have been anticipating for some time. And to see it happen in 2019 is really not at all surprising to us. So a couple reasons for that. First, cybersecurity is becoming increasingly important in government contracting. There are a lot of certifications that come along with it. Some of the compliance requirements here are a bit of a moving target. And I think the potential damages in some of these cases, given the fact that there are certifications of compliance that are required, make cyber kind of an attractive area for False Claims Act activity from the whistleblower's perspective. Maybe you could shed a little bit of light on some of the actions that companies in this space could take to try to minimize their False Claims Act exposure and risk.
As you said, the cybersecurity standards are a little bit of a moving target. The government asks its contractors to represent compliance with sometimes a whole host of federal specific standards. Some of these have some flexibility in how a company meets them based on your environment, your system, your hardware. Others are a little more cut and dry. But all of it is sort of a comprehensive cybersecurity compliance package. And when a company like Aerojet represents that they're compliant with all of the standards, that's the area that can be fraught with risk when you're 50% compliant or 30% compliant with the whole package. Generally, a company's cybersecurity programs should make sure they're emphasizing ongoing identification and assessment and remediation, actually fix the problem of any cybersecurity vulnerabilities or threats that you find, and include within that process a review and assessment of any security findings like bug bounties where white hat hackers go out and poke holes in your product and they report to the company, look, we found a security flaw. A company that's a government contractor should take into consideration both internal reviews and findings and reportings and also reviews and findings from outside the company. I believe in the Cisco case, the reviewer who found security vulnerabilities wasn't even a direct employee of the company, but was a partner of Cisco through a Danish networking company. And he reported security findings through a bug bounty program that they have. Another point is, and this relates to a security vulnerability, the government expects its contractors to continuously monitor and improve their security measures. It's not a one and done certification where you say at the date of contract award, I'm compliant with, you know, these standards right now. The standards themselves, the NIST standards that Mike mentioned earlier, within them require companies to do ongoing vulnerability assessments, testing, reviews, internal and external audits. And so in order to say you are compliant with the NIST standards, you have to be doing these things. And that's an ongoing project to constantly monitor these things and then fix them.
One of the things that, you know, we think about from a False Claims Act perspective is, you know, what happens when you're put on notice of a weakness or an issue and you don't fully address it. So from a cyber perspective, do you have any thoughts on, you know, how best to deal with some of these remediation plans?
I mean, not every security vulnerability is going to be the same. As a practical matter, some may require maybe a change in company policies or procedures or a change on some configuration setting on the system. But others are hard decisions for the company. They might involve replacing hardware or networks or maybe just move things to a segregated environment. If you're trying to meet export control requirements, that's often what a lot of companies do. They have a separate enclave that's U.S. persons only to comply with the International Traffic and Arms Regulation. And that might be a decision the company has to make. So a couple of challenges for companies when they get these remediation reports are, the reviewers don't necessarily always tell the company what to prioritize. They tell them what are some of the higher risk findings, but then they leave it to the company to have to address, well, what are we going to prioritize based on available resources and time constraints? If you can sort of knock out the low-hanging fruit, that's usually a good response. What are the things in these vulnerability assessments that you could do relatively efficiently and relatively quickly and stick with the deadlines? Well, some of the things that we've both seen in these scenarios are the government, again, as you said, some of these are discoverable documents. The government will also take issue if in your remediation plans, it said you were going to accomplish something in 30, 60, 90 days, and then it's pretty clear you didn't, because that itself shows that the company may not be taking the vulnerability as seriously as the government would like.
Yeah, those are all really good points. They're important from a False Claims Act perspective too, because you have somebody, an expert that you brought in from outside, they identify, you know, a whole host of areas where you might be able to do a little bit better. And if that report just gets mothballed or doesn't get taken seriously, in some ways you may be worse off than you were before because you brought somebody in that jumped out at me before we get into the nuts and bolts of the False Claims Act aspects of this is, you know, particularly the Aerojet case, where there was kind of a self-attestation from the contractor that the contractor had met certain standards. You'd made the point earlier that that's in many ways not kind of a classic False Claims Act situation, because, you know, as we've said, Aerojet wasn't a situation where the contractor was actually, you know, selling anything like that to the government, but rather they were assuring the government they were going to be able to appropriately manage government information. So maybe talk a little bit more about that and how that really jumped out at you from a cyber perspective.
Yeah, that gets to sort of the self-attestation model that the Department of Defense mostly and other government agencies have had in the last few years, where the compliance requirements ask the contractor to, you know, represent, yes, I meet this standard, or if I don't, they expect you to explain why you don't. But until very recently, the government in an Aerojet type situation where you have the DoD clause has not taken it upon itself to verify, go and actually do an audit, to do an assessment, to go and say, we want to see your system security plan, your SSP for your contractor systems that hold our government information. And we want to test and review and audit to make sure you're meeting these controls. And it's worth noting for companies now that, particularly with the Aerojet case and how this has played out, in just the past year, DoD has been very clear that self-attestation is just not good enough. DoD customer agencies should consider putting in their contracts language that says, contractor, provide your system security plan for review. And that kind of raises a whole new host of issues taking Aerojet and going forward, which is, in that scenario, DoD may be making a determination on whether or not what the contractor says they're doing is adequate and sufficient to meet the security control. And as you mentioned earlier, a lot of these standards are kind of moving targets. So this could raise questions about DoD's now looking at your security documents, possibly in response to a solicitation. You don't even have the contract yet. How are they going to use that as a gating criteria? Navy went a little further with this, and they revised their acquisition regulations in the past year to flat out say standard language requires contractors to provide their system security plan. And then it goes further to say, if we don't like what's in your system security plan, we may request you fix things. And then we want to see your plan of action milestones, your POAM. So Aerojet is a good marker in terms of what the standards were for self-attestation. But going forward, we're going to start seeing DoD wanting to see more. And as you mentioned, having an outside assessor do an audit or provide remediation recommendations, those might become part of this, part of all of your security documentation the government sees. So this could even grow the potential False Claims Act risks here when the government sees more of these documents. So in order to represent you do or do not meet a given control, that could become a question. The government won't want to say, we want to know how you're really meeting it. So related to that, I wanted to ask you from an FCA perspective in these two cases, when it comes to cybersecurity issues, how are you calculating the damages? And, you know, how does the government address the materiality of meeting cybersecurity requirements?
Aerojet actually puts this kind of squarely at issue, because the complaint in the Aerojet case raised a theory of damages based on fraud and the inducement. The idea here from the relator's perspective is that the misstatements that the defendants allegedly made basically caused the government to award contracts that it otherwise wouldn't have awarded. And that's a really important point of disagreement in this case between the plaintiff and the defendant, because when there's a fraud in the inducement theory, as opposed to maybe a more commonly found benefit of the bargain type damages theory, and the argument is the government wouldn't have awarded the contract absent the bad conduct, the damages are potentially the full value of the contract. So you can see that the risk here on a fraud in the inducement theory, which is often based on a false certification, is significant. So I suspect that going forward, we're going to continue to see disagreements between plaintiffs and defendants in terms of the appropriate measure of damages. And in some ways, that's no different than a lot of False Claims Act litigation, where there's often a pretty significant dispute in terms of what's the proper measure of damages. From a defensive perspective, we're always going to be arguing that the measure of damages is something other than a fraud in the inducement theory. And we're probably going to be advancing arguments that would say, look, even if there was some sort of problematic conduct here. At worst, it simply reduced the value of the goods or services. So any damages here are going to be a small fraction of the full value of the contract. So I think that's one issue that we're going to see a lot of. And the other issue is the question of materiality. Supreme Court explained a few years back in the Escobar case that the materiality standard is one that is demanding. And part of that analysis is the impact that any alleged misrepresentation has on the government's behavior. So from a cyber perspective, questions that I think are going to continue to be relevant in future years are the extent to which the government was aware of the contractor's noncompliance, how closely integrated the cybersecurity requirements are to the goods or services that are being provided. And I think if we look pretty closely at the Aerojet decision, what you'd see there is that the government really didn't look very favorably on a number of arguments that the defense advanced that were focused on materiality.
The first thing that comes to mind is when we're particularly thinking about the self-attestation scenario in Aerojet is in the past year, there have been a couple of federal acquisition regulation rulemakings that are in contracts now that reference particular prohibited sources of supply for products and services. So more than a year ago, the Department of Homeland Security issued a binding operational directive telling agencies to, as the vernacular has been with industry, rip and replace any Kaspersky Labs products from their systems. And then a FAR rulemaking extended that to contractor environments. We also saw a rulemaking come out in the summer that actually was revised on Friday, the 13th of December, about certain telecommunication services and products from certain countries and certain named entities. And this is from the National Defense Authorization Act. So Congress took that action. But what's interesting is the clauses repeat the same self-attestation model that Aerojet had trouble with. They require a contractor to certify compliance with these various clauses that they do not have any of these covered products or services in anything they sell to the government or within anything the contractor uses internally to provide services to the government. So this is an area that is possibly still ripe for another whistleblower type situation like Aerojet saw. If a person in the security or supply chain or contracting function has information on whether or not a company really does or doesn't have these things in their systems. A couple other things that are coming up. We talked about the representations that Aerojet made were that they were in compliance with the NIST 800-171 standard. That's the standard for controlled unclassified information, or CUI. Department of Defense has had a rule out for a number of years now requiring contractors to represent they meet the safeguarding standards for CUI in performance of DoD contracts. However, the CUI program, which is run by the National Archives, has been around for a long time. There are other types of federal CUI in this ecosystem. It's just DoD is the only entity that currently has a contract clause. So we've been waiting for a while to see when civilian agencies, through a FAR clause or agency specific, will start putting their own security requirements in about these clauses. The last thing I want to note is the DoD cybersecurity requirements. There is a 800-171B publication, which will have heightened requirements for certain critical programs. And there's also a cybersecurity maturity model certification, CMMC, that DoD has announced that they're going to start rolling out in 2020, which will impose, though it's based on the current standards of 800-171, will impose new standards, new requirements, and new things that DoD contractors are going to have to comply with.
That's great. So I think takeaway from today is that cybersecurity False Claims Act risk that we've highlighted in 2019 is probably not aberrational. Probably going to continue to see it going forward. And Mike, I appreciate you sitting down with me today to talk about this. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us today. For additional analysis on this topic and others around the False Claims Act, please download our latest publication, FCA Guide 2019 and the Road Ahead, from HoganLevels.com.